first, let's talk about, you know, securing our border and the illegal sanctuary state. I am the only candidate in the entire race that has always believed in securing our border and, yes, of course, building a wall on our border. You know, look, this is very simple. This is not a revolutionary idea. When everybody leaves their house in the morning, they lock their front door. When you leave your car, you lock your car. So, of course, as a nation, we have the right to secure our border and make sure we know who is coming into our country. Everybody's welcome to come in, but they need to come in the front door, and they need to be the right sort of people.
Republican State Assemblyman Travis Allen from Huntington Beach, he's running to be the next governor of California. We'll wrap our series of interviews with the top candidates in the race later in the show with Travis Allen. But first, Mark Zuckerberg has extended his Facebook apology tour to Europe. Yesterday, he got a frosty reception from members of the European Parliament, like Belgian Guy Verhofstadt.
I really think we have a big problem here. And it's not solved by saying we're going to fix it ourselves. And you have to ask yourself how you will be remembered as one of the three big internet giants, together with Steve Jobs, I should say, and Bill Gates, who have enriched our world and our societies. Or on the other hand, in fact, a genius who created a digital monster that is destroying our democracies and our societies for the moment. That's a question that you have to put yourself for yourself.
The EU's new online privacy law, the General Data Protection Regulation, or GDPR, takes effect on Friday. It tightens restrictions on how consumer data can be handled, and it may hit Facebook's bottom line, and it may hit that bottom line hard. Here to tell us more is Will Oremus, senior tech writer for Slate. Hey there.
Hey, Madeline.
Well, I guess you weren't hanging out in Brussels yesterday, but tell us a little bit more about this session that Zuckerberg had with the European Parliament members.
Well, the good news for those who would like to see Facebook held to account is that the questions were very smart. They were very sharp. The European legislators evinced a more nuanced understanding of how Facebook works than their stateside equivalent did when Congress had Zuckerberg testify recently earlier this year. The bad news is that the format of the hearings was really not conducive to getting answers from Mark Zuckerberg. They had all of the members of the European Parliament ask their questions in a row without Zuckerberg answering, and then they gave him 20 minutes at the end to really selectively answer the kinds of things that he wanted to talk about in the first place.
Oh, that's weird. So then they couldn't get the answers that they wanted. So was it mainly just a PR vehicle for them?
You know, you could look at it that way. They did seem very upset at the end. I mean, they at the end of the session, they were saying, well, you know, you better get back to us with those answers, Zuckerberg. So, of course, he promised to do that, just as he did with U.S. Congress. And in fact, Facebook has followed up with some important data in response to the questions that it got from Congress that Zuckerberg didn't answer at the time.
Okay, let me play a clip of tape from the German representative Manfred Weber.
Would you consider your company as a monopoly? And I have to say, as a politician, I believe in markets and rules, but I also want to stop all kinds of possible monopolies. And that's why I think it is time to discuss breaking Facebook monopoly, because it's already too much power in only one hand.
So could they actually do that? Could they break up Facebook in the EU?
No, I don't think that the EU can unilaterally break up Facebook, which is a U.S.-based company. However, this type of antitrust scrutiny from Europe can often lead to problems for tech companies. We saw it with Google when the EU was going after Google for how it ranked its search results. There was a 2.4 billion euro judgment against Google last year that they had to pay. They're now appealing it. So the EU can take meaningful action against Facebook if they believe that Facebook is behaving in a monopolistic way. I don't think they can single-handedly break it up.
Okay, let's talk about this new law, the General Data Protection Regulation. It's a mouthful. What will it do?
The GDPR was approved by the EU in 2016, and it takes effect Friday, as you mentioned. And it requires a whole host of new actions from basically any company that collects data about users online. One of the rules is that they have to report any data breach to the government within 72 hours. They have to give people the ability to access all the private data that the company has collected on them and find out how the company is using that data. It includes a very controversial provision called the right to be forgotten, where you can try to force a company to delete the data that it has on you, and not only that, but hide your information from others on the web. That's something that's contested in a lot of different ways. And it broadens the legal definition of personal data. So it's a very sweeping set of new privacy rules. You could argue, I mean, we'd all be better off if the web had been built with these sort of rules in the first place.
Mm. And the fines are pretty hefty, right, for violations?
Yeah, there are hefty fines, and it is, but it does sound like there will be some leeway for companies. There was a survey that came out last month that found only about half of companies are ready for it. Mm-hmm. And so there will be companies out of compliance on Friday. Some of the very biggest companies like Facebook say they will be fully compliant. They have huge teams that can work on this. Smaller companies are still scrambling. I know that even my colleagues on the legal side at Slate are working on this. How do we make sure that we're disclosing all the data to our users that we're supposed to?
That's interesting. Well, they have had 2 years to get ready for this.
Yes, yeah, they've had plenty of time. But you know, the guidance on exactly what would be allowed and what wouldn't and what you could get away with, that has been something that has evolved over time.
Well, so you have a multinational company like Facebook. Now it has to follow these European rules, including, as you say, the right to be forgotten. How would that affect us here in the United States? Would they have two different systems, or will we now have a Facebook that abides by the European rules?
Yeah, somewhere in between, actually. So if you are a company that serves people in the EU, then you have to be compliant in the EU with GDPR. For a lot of companies, it's simpler just to go ahead and do all the same stuff for customers in the US. You know, if you have to go ahead and implement all these privacy settings and notifications in the EU, you might as well do it everywhere. On the other hand, it is not accurate to say that US users will get all the same protections, because even if you get some of the same features from your online services in the United States, you will not have the same legal remedies that you would if you were using those services in Europe. Facebook in particular has said that they will voluntarily roll out a lot of the same features, if not all the same features, for US users. But again, you can't, if you're in the United States, you can't go and sue Facebook under, you know, the right to be forgotten, or you can't sue it for not following through on these things that you could sue it for if you were in Europe.
Okay, let's talk about fake news. And Russia, as we know, has posted a lot of it on Facebook. Today, the company has some new initiatives to combat that. What's it going to do?
Yeah, Facebook came out with sort of what I would consider a PR blitz today. They released a short film. This is really highly produced mini documentary by a professional video director interviewing Facebook employees and outside experts about the problem of fake news and what are some of the trade-offs involved in trying to fight it, and how can Facebook limit fake news without censoring dissenting political viewpoints. They're also at the same time announcing an expansion of a news literacy campaign where they'll be placing ads in print magazines. They'll be running a notice at the top of people's news feeds, giving them tips on how to spot fake news. And they're also working on supporting some independent research by academics on the effect of social media on elections. It's really, you know, I don't know how substantive this news is. I think to me, what's interesting is that it signals Facebook is taking a very different approach to public relations than it has in the past, and a different approach than a lot of tech companies do, which is it is trying to criticize itself. It's trying to preempt all the criticism it gets from the media by asking itself these tough questions and producing its own content that tries to explain from Facebook's perspective why this stuff is complicated and why it's not easy and how it's genuinely trying to address it.
All right. Well, thanks, Will.
Thanks, Madeline.
That's Will Oremus. He is senior tech writer for Slate. Coming up, Republican Assemblyman Travis Allen wants to be the next governor of California, and he doesn't think being a conservative in a liberal state is a big problem. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. We're going to wrap up our series of interviews with the top contenders in the race to be California's next governor. Today, we have Republican State Assemblyman Travis Allen. He represents parts of Orange County, including Huntington Beach. A new LA Times poll has him falling into fifth place. The primary is June 5th. The top two vote getters will advance to the November general election. I spoke with Travis Allen earlier. Well, people are just tuning in now to this race, and they may not really know that much about you. So introduce yourself.
Absolutely. So I am a Californian born and raised. I was born in San Diego, grew up about 5 minutes from the border in a little town called Chula Vista. Lived here my entire life. As a matter of fact, I started managing money in 96 as an investment advisor, and I opened up my company in 2001. And I lived down in Huntington Beach, where I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records for riding the biggest surfboard ever built. And we had 66 people on one wave at one time. But, you know, unfortunately, I've had to watch as my family and friends have all left the state. My parents now live on the southern Oregon coast because they couldn't afford to build it here in California. My brother lives in Tucson, Arizona, which is where Raytheon took all their jobs from Los Angeles. And my best friend moved to Texas, where he doubled the size of his house, doubled the size of his business, and pays no state income tax. As for my clients, they all started in California. They're now in 22 different states around the nation. And, you know, my family and friends and clients didn't leave because something changed in our state with the weather or, you know, with the sun and the sand and the mountains and the forest. It was because the California Democrats have run the state into the ground. I got elected in 2012. I've been elected for the last 6 years. I am known as the most conservative voice in Sacramento. And after 6 years of fighting the California Democrats, I've realized the only way to truly change the state, to truly take back California, is as the next governor of the state of California. And that's exactly what I'm going to do.
Okay. And you are an avid supporter of President Trump's and voted for him. He endorsed your opponent, your Republican opponent, John Cox, in this race last week. Why do you think he endorsed John Cox? And it's not just the president. The House Majority Leader, Kevin McCarthy, California's most prominent Republican, has also endorsed Cox.
Well, yes. Those are actually both intertwined. So Kevin McCarthy has a simple objective, and that's to be the Speaker of the House. In order for him to do that, he needs money and he needs to keep his 14 congressional seats. So he took a very simple look at the race and said, you know, John Cox might be a failed politician from Chicago who only moved to California in 2011 as a resident. But, you know, John Cox has put $5 million into this race so far. Despite the fact that, you know, Cox can't seem to get out of that second place and certainly can't beat me despite spending $5 million. Kevin McCarthy said, look, you know, he needs the money to be the Speaker of the House, and he wants to protect these seats. So he wanted to go with the easy bet, and that's exactly what he did, and that's exactly what he convinced the president to do. Now, unfortunately, the president has a track record of supporting the establishment candidates. We remember Luther Strange and many others who did not win. So although we have seen some endorsements, unfortunately, they went the other way due to John Cox's money, it's very clear that the California Republicans are on the side of our campaign and definitely want Travis Allen to be next governor of the state of California. And we have over 40,000 volunteers. I am the only Ken in the race that actually voted for the president and supported the president.
Well, and, do you still support him even though he doesn't support you?
Oh, 100%. Look, you know, I don't fault Trump for making a mistake. I fully expect my phone to be ringing just about 2 weeks here. And it will be the White House, and he'll be saying, look, you know, I made a bad call, and I fully support you to be the next president or the next governor of the state of California, which is exactly what we're going to do. And I think what's most important to understand here is there's actually only one candidate in the race that's won every race that they've ever run. One candidate in the race that has 40,000 volunteers up and down the state and almost 500,000 followers on Facebook alone. You know, there is only one person with a track record that truly represents an agenda of putting California first and California citizens first. And that's exactly what I've done for 6 years in the legislature. And that's exactly what we're going to do to win this governor's race.
Okay. Let's talk about immigration and crime. You support President Trump's plan to build a border wall. You are against the state's sanctuary law. You say it's about keeping Californians safe. But overall, crime rates have gone up a bit over the last couple of years. But in general, they are still a lot lower, drastically lower than they were in the 1980s and 90s. They're in the 1960s levels. So why do you link the two, sanctuary state policies and increased crime?
Well, let's be very clear. These are different subjects, but they do interconnect. First, let's talk about, you know, securing our border and the illegal sanctuary state. I am the only candidate in the entire race that has always believed in securing our border. And yes, of course, building a wall on our border. You know, look, this is very simple. This is not a revolutionary idea. When everybody leaves their house in the morning, they lock their front door. When you leave your car, you lock your car. So of course, as a nation, we have the right to secure our border and make sure we know who is coming into our country. Everybody's welcome to come in, but they need to come in the front door and they need to be the right sort of people. So yes, I'm the only candidate that's always believed in that. The other Republican in the race, this guy by the name of John Cox, has flip-flopped on his support for the wall. When he ran for president in 2007, he said he parted company with people that wanted to build a wall. And as recently as January of this year, was on Univision talking to Hispanic audiences, telling them that a wall might not be the best idea. So there is only one candidate in the race that believes in securing the border.
I think everyone is in favor of securing the border, but they think a wall is superfluous. We have a border security system.
No, and that's entirely incorrect. Look, our southern border is porous in many places, and I know this intimately and personally. I grew up 5 minutes from it in Chula Vista, and I can tell you, you know, without a doubt, that we do need to secure our border. And yes, that does mean building a wall. And it's actually very easy to do. And it's actually non-controversial. It's only been made controversial by the Democrats for some strange reason. Last I checked, I think they all lock their front doors when they leave their homes, too. But
I think people are saying, look, it seems very expensive for a not very big piece of land. I mean, this is a $25 billion price tag. It seems that money could be spent better in other ways.
Absolutely incorrect. Look, you know, what does it cost to have, you know, one extra violent crime because of someone coming into this country illegally that is now committing crimes here? You know, what is the cost of having, you know, a ton?
So you are linking the border wall with increased crime.
Well, without a doubt. I mean, look, if you take a look at the illegal immigrant population in California and across the United States, they commit crimes at a much higher rate than the rest of the population.
That's not true. All studies have shown that immigrants commit fewer crimes than native-born Americans.
Actually, that's entirely untrue. And this is according to ICE data in 2015, as published in the San Diego Union-Tribune. So the story is very simple. On a whole, immigrants coming to the United States may have differing levels of violating our laws. But when you're talking about illegal immigrants in the United States, illegal immigrants have a much higher propensity to commit crimes. And that is according to
Gaines. Well, if you're including crimes of crossing the border.
No, we're talking about future crimes. Crimes like murder, crimes like kidnapping, crimes like drug trafficking. Data shows conclusively that people that come here illegally commit crimes at higher rates than legal immigrants and than California and U.S. citizens. That's according to official ICE data in 2015. And it's very clear. This illegal sanctuary state is the concept that people that came here illegally that are committing crimes while they are here are now being sheltered with our taxpayer dollars. And this is where the media gets it wrong, because the media wants to conflate. They want to try to combine legal immigration and illegal immigration, and then the sanctuary state. They're three totally different things. You know, the sanctuary state concept is not talking about someone's grandmother sitting on a couch at home. It's talking about somebody that came here illegally that is committing crimes while they are here, and now they're being sheltered with our taxpayer dollars. That policy is illegal, it is dangerous, it is unconstitutional, and very simply, in my first 100 days in office, I have stated conclusively that we will gather the signatures to put it on the ballot with a special election before the people of California to reverse the illegal sanctuary state.
I just want to go back to what you were saying. You were citing this ICE data in terms of increased crime committed by undocumented immigrants. There is a current peer-reviewed journal called Criminology, which has studied undocumented immigration since 1990 and has found that there has not been increased violent crime since then. So I'm just wondering exactly where your statistics are coming from to make the claim that undocumented immigrants are committing these crimes.
So this data comes from a 2015 ICE study that was done. It was then reported in the San Diego Union-Tribune, and it was absolutely conclusive that illegal immigrants are committing crimes at higher rates. And here I have the numbers for you right here. Undocumented immigrants, these are illegal immigrants, only account for 3.5% of the U.S. population, but account for 37% of federal sentences nationwide. illegal immigrants comprise 12% of murder sentences, 20% of kidnapping sentences, and 16% of drug trafficking sentences. Think about this. You know, illegal immigrants are, they say, about 7% of the California population, but account for over 12% of the state's prison population. And an estimated 650 illegal immigrants are actually, that have already committed crimes, are now being released from California jails into California communities every single month. These numbers are staggering. And the answer is very simple. There is a right way to come to our country. It's called our legal immigration system, and it works just fine.
Okay, let's move on to another topic. The gas tax, you've said that's one of your first priorities. If elected to office, you would end the gas tax. There is a measure on the ballot that would do that, that would repeal the gas tax. Why is that priority number one for you?
Job number one is cutting taxes in California overall. And very simply, this is how you create the most good for the most number of people. Look, when Donald Trump cut taxes in the United States, it created $8 trillion of wealth, with the lowest unemployment on record for African Americans and Latinos ever recorded. Lowest unemployment since 2000, lowest jobless claims since the year I was born in 1973. This means that people can pay their rents, they can pay their mortgages, they can put clothes on their kids' backs and food on their table. This is good in the world, regardless whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or don't even care about politics. As it relates to California, Jerry Brown got elected in 2010 with a simple campaign promise of no new taxes without voter approval. Jerry Brown lied to the California people. He raised our gas taxes by 12 cents per gallon, 20 cents per gallon on diesel, and our car registrations by up to $175 per year without a vote of the people. He gave us instead a corrupted process through the legislature. He actually bribed four legislators $1 billion of our tax money to pass this tax. He bribed one Republican that voted for this, and the one Republican received $500 million for his district, and of that $500 million, $400 million went to an extension of the high-speed rail.
Okay. The argument, obviously, for the gas tax is that it has been 23 years since the last statewide increase, that it would raise needed money, $5.2 billion a year for road and bridge repairs and mass transit. It would provide jobs for people to fix the roads. And so I guess the question is, how do you pay for all of this without raising taxes, and taxes that haven't been raised in a generation?
Yeah, very simply, look, that statement presupposes that taxes always have to go up in California. That's absolute nonsense.
Well, costs go up.
But you got to understand, there's a difference. So I'm an economist by trade. There's a difference between your tax rate going up and your tax revenue going up. Tax revenue in California has exploded, and the tax rates have also gone up at the same time. What you need to know is that tax rates can actually go down and tax revenue can go up. If you cut taxes, people are more productive, and so they'll ultimately pay more money to the government, but it's because they're putting more money in their pocket. Instead, what the California Democrats have done is they've raised our taxes unnecessarily. And let me explain. In 2010, Jerry Brown was elected, and this California state budget in the general fund was $86 billion. Today, California's general fund budget is over $138 billion. That's an increase of just in eight years, over $52 billion or 50%. This is astronomical. This is because of Prop 30, which was, of course, supposed to be temporary, but now is practically permanent. And of course, this is because of this gas tax that we don't need.
The economy got a lot better. And so people are making more money, especially the top earners. And so there are more tax revenues. And now there's a $9 billion surplus.
Which proves my point. We do not need another tax in California. California already has plenty of money to fix our roads and expand our freeways. We just need to spend our existing money much better. And I would tell you on top of this, not only will we repeal the gas tax on day one, because it will be on your ballot in November and the voters will repeal that on day one. Past that, we're going to go after all of the other taxes in California, and we're going to cut them as well. We're going to cut the state's highest in the nation income tax, the highest in the nation sales tax, and yes, we're going to cut corporate tax as well.
Okay, we have a huge housing issue, housing problem. Housing costs are stratospheric, as I think you alluded to in your opening statement about people fleeing the state for cheaper places to live, as you mentioned as well, a huge homeless problem. How would you get a lot more housing built quickly in California?
So it's actually very, very simple. In California, the median home price is well over 50% the national average. It's just expensive to live here. We have one of the highest costs of living in the state, which is why so many people are leaving our state. In order to build more houses and more apartments and everything else where people can live, and in order to do it quickly and at a much lower price point, we have to do all of the basic things that you would think about. Cut taxes, reform CEQA, cut the excessive regulations, and cut the excessive litigation that is facing developers of properties in California. When we do take these very simple steps of making it less expensive to build homes in California, and we streamline this regulatory process, and we get developers out of courts because they're constantly being sued, which holds the process up for years and years and adds thousands to tens of thousands to even hundreds of thousands of dollars to our cost, people will begin building across the state of California. And we're not just talking about, you know, building dense urban infill where, you know, people have to live in these stack and packs, you know, squeezed white on, one on top of each other. If that's what they want to do, you know, more power to you. I've lived in plenty of cities. That's fine. You can live there. But we also need to build single family homes in California, homes that people actually want to live in with front yards, with backyards. This state has plenty of space. We have the ability to have a housing boom in California. And as an ex-governor of California, I've already committed to building over 1 million homes in my first 4 years in office.
All right. As you noted, this is a Democratic state. The legislature is democratically controlled. If you do win, how would you work with Democrats to get your goals accomplished?
So I've been in the California legislature since 2012, and I have no illusions about how Sacramento works. Very simply, I have a 5-point plan for California. Cut taxes, get tough on crime, fix our roads, expand our freeways, fix our broken education, complete the California State Water Project. I've also pledged to reverse illegal sanctuary state in my first 100 days in office, and finally bring voter ID to California. I know that not one of these ideas we're going to be able to pass for the California State Legislature, which is why we will bring special ballot initiatives to the people of California directly. So you may remember Arnold Schwarzenegger did this famously. The problem was he only did it once, and when he failed, we never saw him again. We need to bring ballot initiatives before the people of California in special elections over and over again until we are able to pass the needed reforms in California and actually get action. So every single one of these 5 points in my 5-point plan, we will do with a direct ballot initiative to the people of California and bypass the legislature entirely.
So you're saying the legislature is unnecessary when you're governor?
No, actually, the legislature is extremely necessary. But the sort of major reforms that California needs will never be passed by the California Democrats. We must take these directly to the people of California.
So why have elected representatives at all? Why not just do everything by ballot initiative?
Well, you know, clearly we have a government to run, and the legislature serves a very real purpose. We, you know, we must have, you know, a balance of power in all levels of government. The problem with the California legislature is it's entirely dominated by the California Democrats. So what they've given us are not only these excessively high taxes, but all the crazy laws that we have now in California, which is why as an ex-governor of California, I'll have the ability to veto these laws that don't make any sense for California. You know, laws like little boys and little girls using the same restroom, or the knowing willing transmission of AIDS to another person is no longer a felony. Now it's just a misdemeanor. These laws don't make any sense to Californians. These laws need to be vetoed. But let's be very clear. There is a role for the legislature. It is through the budget process. It is for, you know, all of these laws that need to be cleaned up in California. And I really hope to work with the Democrats in the legislature. But I have no illusions that the sort of major reforms that California needs, things like cutting taxes and getting tough on crime, securing our borders and reversing illegal sanctuary state, those must go directly before the people of California. We must empower the people to truly take back California.
Republican gubernatorial candidate and state assemblyman Travis Allen, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Okay, and just a note on what he was talking about earlier. We asked his campaign to send us that San Diego Union-Tribune article he cited to support his claim that undocumented immigrants commit crimes at a much higher rate than U.S. citizens. His staff hasn't responded yet, so we went looking for his numbers. And we found some statistics, the same statistics Allen cited, in data from 2014 compiled by the Federal Sentencing Commission. But here's the problem with that data. The vast majority of crimes are prosecuted at the state and local levels, not the federal level. There is no national comprehensive database that tracks the share of murders or other crimes committed by undocumented immigrants. Last year, another politician in Florida cited the same murder statistic as Allen did, and PolitiFact rated the claim as mostly false. Coming up, remembering Philip Roth.
He was the first writer I encountered in whose work I saw my family. I saw people I recognized.
More than 50 years as one of America's greatest authors. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The death of a great American novelist now, Philip Roth. He died yesterday. He was 85. His career began in the 50s and lasted almost until the end of his life. He wrote more than 30 novels and short story collections, and he won every major American literary award, sometimes more than once. Well, to remember his life and work, I'm joined now by writer and critic David Ulin, former book critic for the Los Angeles Times. Hi.
Hey, Madeline, how are you?
I'm great. Well, Philip Roth, you were a huge fan of his, an avid reader of his. What does he mean to you?
Well, he means a lot of things to me. I think first and foremost, he was the first writer I encountered, and I started reading him when I was very young, 12, 13. He was the first writer I encountered in whose work I saw my family. I saw people I recognized. His parents, in many ways, he's pretty much an exact contemporary of my own parents. So his parents, in many ways, were my parents, and the Jewish Newark that he portrayed was very much like the Jewish Brooklyn in which my grandparents had lived and in which my parents were raised. I had never seen us in books before. And although I was an avid reader as a kid and I had already sort of begun to think about wanting to be a writer, it had never really occurred to me that those stories were the kinds of stories that one could tell. Obviously, there were other writers who I didn't know at that point, Mordecai Richler, Saul Bellow, et cetera, who were kind of working in the same territory. But for me, Roth was the one who opened the door.
And then, well, speaking of a young Jewish boy, Goodbye Columbus, and then Portnoy's Complaint. Did those two speak to you on a personal level?
Well,
I don't want you to get too graphic, but
I will keep it as, you know, I will not be as graphic as Alexander Portnoy. But I read Portnoy's Complaint the summer I was 13. So as you can imagine, there was a lot in that book for a adolescent 13-year-old boy to respond to, partly the baseball obsession, partly the sort of pushback against parental expectations and a kind of dominating mother figure, and certainly partly some of the erotic material.
Right. And that got him into trouble with other Jews, actually. Many came out and said that he was self-hating and that book was anti-Semitic.
Well, it's actually really interesting because this goes back to the beginning of his career. And, you know, even as far back as the late 50s, before he had published a book, he was attacked for a story that appeared in The New Yorker called Defender of the Faith. And a lot of that material got cycled into his fictional world in The Ghostwriter. You know, Nathan Zuckerman, that's the first book in the Zuckerman trilogy or in the Zuckerman series. That book involves a young Jewish writer, Roth's alter ego in many ways, Nathan Zuckerman, dealing with an enormous amount of pressure from the Jewish community because he was writing stories that they felt cast the Jews in a bad light. You know, in terms of thinking about those historical circumstances, late 1950s, it's only 14 years after the Holocaust. Anti-Semitism is still a big part, I think, of American cultural life. It still is a big part of American cultural life. And so that sense of a kind of community wanting its artists to protect it rather than reveal it in all of its facets emerges as early as the 50s or the late 50s. But certainly Portnoy, in terms of the characters, let's say his more base motivations in terms of kind of the brutality of the book. Roth told me once in an interview that he considered that book he most thought about Portnoy's Complaint in terms of its brutality, the brutality of sort of the family dynamics and the kind of way that family members sort of try through various means to brutalize each other into operating according to certain parameters. All of that got an enormous amount of pushback, and he was regarded very much as a self-hating Jew.
Yeah.
I want to say his true subject really was the subject of consciousness. And so although he writes about different characters, and I don't want to make the mistake of saying that the books are strictly autobiographical, of course they have a lot of autobiographical elements, but the characters are different. But in that exploration of consciousness and how we change and develop, how the interior narrative actually becomes the kind of exterior narrative, he got into a lot of fascinating territory. That brutality, I think, is really an aspect or a a discovery, let's say, of his early work, as he became older and began not just sort of in terms of the novels, but even as he gets into sort of some of the memoir work, Patrimony, which is a book he wrote, published in the late 80s, essentially about taking care of his father and nursing him into the grave, which I think is one of the most beautiful, moving memoirs I've ever read, and one of Roth's most magnificent books. That perspective keeps getting bigger and changing. The older he gets, the more complicated it gets. And in that way, in some way, kind of the more miraculous it gets.
Right, right. When you can understand more about what your father was going through or who he was and have some empathy as you get older and truly understand. I just want to play a clip of tape of him. He's talking to the New York Times and talking about inventing his character, Nathan Zuckerman, his so-called alter ego, and the evolution of that character.
I invented this writer because I had had a strong experience in visiting Eastern Europe in 1972, I think it was. I saw guys living under tyranny, really. And the contrast between how I lived as a writer and how they lived as a writer was very strong. So I wanted to write a book about that. Of course, in the beginning, I had no idea he would be a character that would appear in book after book. All of them were about the unforeseen consequences of art. Then Zuckerman emerged as the voice and brain of American pastoral, of I Married a Communist, and of the Human Stain. He'd been an actor in the earlier books. And now he's no longer the actor, he's the reporter, the imaginer, the intelligence.
I'm going to miss that intelligence. Can you talk a little bit more about that character and how it evolved over his novels?
Well, I think Zuckerman's a really interesting character in that he begins, the first Zuckerman novel is The Ghostwriter, which came out in 1979 and in many ways was a kind of rejuvenation of Roth's career. He had Portnoy, I think, had kind of wandered through the wilderness in a lot of ways. I mean, wrote some interesting books, but sort of was looking for something. And I think Zuckerman allowed him to refocus. And as he says there, I think that question of the unforeseen consequence of art. Later in life, he would sort of talk about Portnoy's complaint. He had mixed feelings, I think, about the book, or certainly about its reception. But in many ways, he kind of keeps coming back to it because that's the book that it sort of took him individually into a place that he wasn't expecting to go. He was not expecting to become a celebrity or a brand name, and that book is the book that created that for him. And not only that, I think the autobiographical aspects of that book made people associate him with Portnoy. Ironically, the same is true in terms of Zuckerman, although Roth kind of created that in the sense that Zuckerman becomes a writer who undergoes many of the same controversies Roth underwent, even writing a novel called Karnofsky that's a very Portnoy-esque book. But in the end, once the trilogy is done, Zuckerman continues to sort of animate books all the way up into, for many years, into the aughts, and becomes, I think, in a way, kind of the conscience of Roth's body of work, even to the point that in his first sort of memoir, collection of autobiographical nonfiction, The Facts, Roth brackets it with a correspondence between himself and Zuckerman, in which Zuckerman urges him not to publish the book. So I think that there, you know, for a number of reasons, Zuckerman became not just a kind of alter ego or a character, but in many ways a kind of, as I say, a conscience or even a kind of imaginative or imaginary sounding board.
What did he make of the criticism that he received from some feminists that his female characters were not as fully drawn or not as fully imagined as his male characters, and that sometimes he's portraying a sexist viewpoint?
He's absolutely portraying a sexist viewpoint. There's no question about it. I think, you know, Roth kind of pushed that off in some way, or said that he was exploring sort of male desire or male lust as filtered through in some ways his own imagination or his own experience. I think that's true. And I think that in some ways his portrait of male lust, or of a certain kind of male lust, let's say, is accurate to what that is. It can be quite an ugly thing to look at. I agree entirely as a reader that his female characters are, I think sometimes it would almost, we're being generous to say that they're two-dimensional, and that he didn't, but I don't think that interested him. I do think that that is a lacking in his writing. But I also think in the end that every writer or every artist tells the story that they have to tell or creates the work that they have to create. And so in some ways, I think the challenges, or we could call them the weaknesses in Roth's writing in terms of being able to imagine his way into full-blooded, three-dimensional female characters had to do with Roth's own interior positioning.
Hmm. Okay, and finally, it feels like the end of an era, and I know that that's kind of a cliche that people bandy about, but you've got, you know, Saul Bellow is dead, Norman Mailer is dead, and now Philip Roth, the great American white male authors who came to prominence in the mid-20th century. He's the last one.
He is the last one. I think it is, in many ways, the end of an era. I think in many ways it's an end of an era that should have ended, and I don't mean this in terms of people dying or even in terms of their work, but should have ended years ago. I think one of the things that's really most profoundly exciting about American literature at the moment is this plethora of voices and communities that has emerged. And I think that in some way, not to say that, no knock on those writers, but I think that our kind of insistence as a culture on sort of deifying certain writers or kind of creating that hierarchy is to our detriment in some way. So when I say that the era should have ended, I don't mean that. I realized today that I think I had sort of decided he wasn't going to die at all. And I would love to have seen more books by him. But at the same time, the idea of sort of, you know, the great American novelist, the great American novel, all of those kind of myths and signifiers, I think are more detrimental than they're worth. We are only enlarged by the range of voices and the range of communities represented in the literature. And I wish we were more aware of it now, and I wish we'd been more aware of it for many years.
David Yulin, former book critic for the Los Angeles Times. We're remembering Philip Roth, who died yesterday at the age of 85. David, thank you.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Coming up, why stores are playing classical music to scare off some people from hanging around, and why it works, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Spring. From Antonio Vivaldi's Four Seasons, music you might think sounds really nice, but it's actually quite effective in driving people away. A Burger King in San Francisco is playing Vivaldi and Bach and Mozart all day. For what is unclear, what is clear is that homeless people and others don't really want to hang around when the music is playing. Ted Gioia noticed this on his way home from work, and he wrote about it for the LA Review of Books.
One night after my shift, about 12:30, I was walking home down Market Street, and Beethoven was just blaring at like 12:30 at night. And beyond any reasonable volume, to like an empty sidewalk. And it occurred to me then that there was something going on here more than just orchestral appreciation, as it were.
Because this was really late at night. How many people are out strolling listening to classical music?
The Burger King was closed, so it seemed unlikely they were aiming for the kind of midnight burgers and Baroque crowd.
So you thought, what is really going on? And you did some research?
And I started investigating. Found some interesting blog posts, a lot of short articles. Then I found Lily's amazing book.
Lily is musicologist Lily Hirsch. Her book is Music in American Crime Prevention and Punishment. She's been interested in the topic for more than a decade.
I read an article in 2006 about the method in Australia, and it was classical music, but also Barry Manilow, a music thought uncool. Her name was Lola. And then I started digging, and I remembered it being played in my hometown in California, Santa Rosa, in the 90s. But I kept finding sources referring to the 7-Eleven as the origin. So I contacted the 7-Eleven, and they issued a statement taking credit for the method and giving it its source as British Columbia in 1985. And the idea was that this kind of music was not popular with teens.
Word of the 7-Eleven success apparently spread, and so the idea spread around the world. Shops, restaurants, schools, public plazas all use some of the great works of humanity to shoo kids and ne'er-do-wells away. Hirsch says the message is clear.
It's communicating that you're not wanted. So even if you might like the music, you recognize that and you walk away. It's related to STEPTED, Crime Prevention Through Environmental Design, which uses markers in space to communicate who's allowed to be there and who shouldn't be.
Well, for classical music lovers like a writer in San Francisco, Ted Gioia, that's pretty discouraging. And it has him asking some big questions.
Why is classical music in general and Baroque music specifically so universally successful at repelling young people and people who are deemed unwanted?
And what's the answer?
It says something about how classical music, its class connotations have superseded or overtaken the kind of actual artistry of the music. And so if we want to solve this problem, we need to figure out a new way to present orchestral music to young audiences and to the kind of mass audiences that lets them actually hear it for the first time. So they actually get past their first, I hate Baroque music, and actually start listening to the piece itself. So there's something about that that I think is the key question, is how can we make people listen rather than just react?
All right. So should we join the chorus lamenting the death of a great art form? Is culture dead? Is classical music a thing of the past?
Music will be just fine. I was just reading an article the other day about how Beethoven is being used in Taiwan to signal garbage collection. They play Beethoven and it's just this lovely signal. People come out and bring their garbage.
So in that sense, it's meant to attract people, to make them feel good about, cleaning up their neighborhood and their house.
Yes, you could view this technique as positive or negative. There is an association here with garbage.
Or it's an association with beautification and cleanliness.
Absolutely. It depends on how you look at it.
Author and musicologist Lily Hirsch, and we heard from writer Ted Gioia, talking about how classical music keeps crime and those pesky teenagers away. All right. Now back to the hipster music. I don't know if it's hipster music.
Hipster music.
But it's your music.
It is, yes. And I love it. I love that hipster music. I asked listeners if they hate classical music. And Josh Rock Me Like a Crossfire Hurricane Paul said, I love classical music, but I do not listen to it nearly enough. Liz Dwyer said, what kind of people hate classical music? Blade responded, I do. Can't explain it. Maybe because I played violin when I was a kid. I'm just tired of it. Maybe I don't get it. I don't know. Maikette said, I love classical music. Wish local radio would have less stodgy hosts. I'd love a Mozart in the Jungle type of energy in classical radio. For the poll, 2% of people said, yes, I hate classical music. It's the worst. 26% said, don't hate it. Don't listen to it either. 42% said, I kind of like it. And then 30% said, I love classical music. It's my favorite thing. It's what I listen to most.
I can't believe you didn't do a Barry Manilow poll.
I didn't do a Barry Manilow. That'll have to go tomorrow.
Okay. Right. He does. He writes the songs. All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. He does the feedback. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.